Hello, everyone, and welcome to Awakening the Impulse to Evolve. My name is Craig Hamilton, and I'm the founder of Integral Enlightenment, the organization producing this event. And I'm delighted to have you with us for session 13 of our series featuring Ken Wilber. We only have about a month left in the series, but I want to let you know we have many great events still to come. Elizabeth DeBold will join us this Thursday. Then we have Michael Beckwith and Claire Zammit both next week. Peter Russell and John Stewart on the way after that. So it's great to have you along for the ride, and I hope you'll hang around till the end. The way the event's going to work tonight is that Ken and I will dialogue for about an hour, and then Ken will spend half an hour taking your questions. And then after that, we have our virtual evolutionary cafe where you can join with others in a small group conversation about the topics of the night's call. To do that, you need to dial in through a different number because we use Maestro Conference, and you have to create a personal PIN code to do that. It's all completely free, of course, but you can find info on how to get a PIN code if you're interested in participating in tonight's Evolutionary Cafe. And it's basically a chance to get in small breakout groups with other people, and we just offer some questions for discussion and facilitate it a little bit, but people are really enjoying that. So you can find info on that in the newsletter we sent you yesterday. Okay, logistics behind us. I couldn't be more honored and excited to be here tonight with Ken Wilber. Ken has been a monumental influence in the contemporary spiritual world and many other worlds as well. In fact, he's the man who put the integral in, well, everything. Integral theory, integral philosophy, integral spirituality, integral psychology. I think probably we could add another 15 or so to that list, you name it. And Ken has also had a tremendous impact on my own way of understanding the world. I'm quoting him all the time, and it's an honor to have this chance to talk with him about a topic so close to both of our hearts. For those of you who don't know Ken, he's the most widely translated academic writer in America with 25 books translated into some 30 foreign languages and is the first philosopher psychologist to have his collected works published in his own lifetime. Credited with developing a unified field theory of consciousness, a synthesis and interpretation of the world's great psychological, philosophical, and spiritual traditions, Ken is the most cogent and penetrating voice in the emergence of a uniquely American wisdom. He's widely regarded as the preeminent scholar of integral theory, which continues to gather momentum around the world. And his many books include Grace and Grit, Sex Ecology, Spirituality, and the Everything books, A Theory of Everything and A Brief History of Everything. He's the founder of Integral Institute, Inc., co-founder of Integral Life, Inc., and the senior fellow of Integral Life Spiritual Center. His most recent books include Integral Spirituality, Integral Life Practice, and The Pocket Ken Wilber. And it's hard for us to imagine Ken Wilber's work fitting in anyone's pocket. So, you know, they did a lot of work to condense that baby. One of the things I personally love about you, Ken, is your willingness to continually push the edges of your own understanding and the grace with which you take us all along with you on that journey. So it's a pleasure to welcome you to Awakening Impulse to Evolve.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm very impressed with the work you do, and I'm glad to be a small part of it.
Well, thanks, Ken. Well, so just to tee this up a little bit, the focus of this series is specifically on evolutionary spirituality.
Right.
And the big question that we've been exploring is, how does this newfound understanding of evolution, this recent realization that we're evolving creatures living in an evolving cosmos, how does that insight transform the spiritual path, and how might it transform the spiritual path?
Right.
We're always looking back at this reality that here all the great wisdom traditions of the world were born at a time when we didn't yet know we were part of this upward telos, this evolving process. And it's hard for us now to imagine the world without knowing about evolution, but this is really something that only began to emerge a couple hundred years ago or so, and really only entered the public eye maybe 150 years ago with Darwin's work. So we're just starting to catch up with what this means, and particularly here, we're looking at how does this change our understanding of what it is to be a human being, what we're doing here, the big questions, and particularly the spiritual path and the goal. So I just thought before I get into all the million specific questions I want to ask you, to just get your thoughts on that broad scope about how does the discovery of evolution transform our understanding of our humanity, our spirituality?
Well, you're right. It is a relatively new understanding of humanity's understanding of itself. If you look back at the great religious traditions and look at their unfolding, you can see that around the axial period, 6th century BC, East and West, there started to become an understanding of a transcendental oneness that could be contacted, and it gave you a liberation, a freedom from the suffering and the pain of the manifest world, of the world of the body and the world of the senses, the world of samsara. And so that understanding tended to evolve soon after that, about 600 years after that. You get the notion that this oneness in its pure form is a pure emptiness, an unqualifiable infinite that can't be pegged down or pinned down with any characteristics at all, but is nete nete, not this, not that. And then following that, the third turning of the wheel in Buddhism, for example, was the equation of this emptiness with consciousness, so that your own consciousness per se is one with the infinite and ultimate spirit. But still, all of those, if they had an understanding of development in the sense of stages of meditation and gradual unfolding, that's very true. But it wasn't set in an evolutionary context. It wasn't understood that species evolve, that humans are part of an ongoing evolution that has taken centuries, millennia, to go to unfold. And that really was a new understanding. So the understanding had always been that ultimate enlightenment was the union of emptiness, or empty consciousness, unqualifiable awareness, the union of emptiness and form. And that stayed the same thing, but we started to understand now that the world of form evolves. And so now, all of a sudden, it means that I am one with a non-static world. I'm one with a world that's evolving. And that sort of changes everything. It changes how spirituality is looked at. It changes the ultimate goal of spirituality. The notion of bodhisattva changes from being, in a sense, a static individual to somebody who's evolving. And it just cuts through virtually every understanding that humans had of themselves, is that the world of form is evolving, and although the world of emptiness isn't. So the same emptiness that Gautama Buddha awakened to be the same emptiness that we would awaken to, nonetheless, the world of form has evolved, has changed, has become more complex and more developed. And that thread of increasing complexity is one of the marks of evolution. And so that changes how we tend to understand the world as well. So now, when we get involved in spirituality, for example, and we are, through meditation or some other practice, attempting to find this unity of emptiness and form, the form that we're going to be ushered into is a form that's evolving, a form that is changing, a form that's unfolding and moving forward and driven by an eros to ever greater types of wholeness, ever more unified and holistic forms of existence. So it's an extraordinary change. And like you said, it's really only a couple of hundred years old. We find it starting to appear preeminently in the German idealists, Fichte, Schelling, and Hegel, who sort of made development the cornerstone of their philosophies. But it doesn't appear much before then. And so both East and West had a much more static understanding of the universe. And then all of a sudden, this notion of evolution comes in, and it really just swept through human disciplines like wildfire, and has continued to do so. It's still probably the single most widespread and unchallenged idea in the present world.
That was a beautiful broad sweep. I really appreciate it. And I'm just to drill a little bit more into this, into the implications for those of us who are on a spiritual path. So,
right.
and how it transforms that. Because, see, I know many people today, you know, most of us postmoderns and integral, everybody embraces the notion of evolution, and many now embrace the idea that, that spirituality is evolutionary. So we have a lot of people saying, yes, when we think about, you know, when we look at spirituality, it's proof that we have higher evolution or, you know, further to go on our evolutionary path because we have these great saints who have realized oneness. And therefore, the realization of oneness or the ground of being is proof of a higher evolutionary possibility. And so they sort of say, yes, all spirituality is evolutionary because we're seeing that we can, you know, become a more wise, enlightened, saintly being, and that would be a higher evolutionary stage. But I hear in what you're saying something deeper, much more nuanced in the sense that not just traditional mysticism now being understood as evolutionary, but a new kind of a way in which the path itself, the experience of the path itself, and our understanding of the kind of the complexity of evolution, that there's a transformation of actually what spirituality is now.
Right.
Am I hearing that? Yeah.
Yeah, because what it means, particularly as we put on our evolutionary glasses and then look at history through that lens, what it means, among other things, is that when we talk about the union of emptiness and form, and we say, okay, this world of form is evolving, and then we look at how that form has evolved, and it's really quite shocking the degree of change that these evolutionary stages in humanity's own unfolding have brought into existence. So if we look at Gene Gebser, for example, who is one of the pioneers in looking at the development and evolution of human culture, human being in the world, and following their worldviews, following the way individuals picture and view and interpret the world around them. And he found five or six major stages that were both phylogenetic, both going back to the beginning of human history some 500,000 years ago, and ontogenetic, stages that were repeated in today's individuals from birth forward. And the names of these stages pretty much are self-explanatory. The stages that he found, he termed archaic, magic, mythic, rational, pluralistic, and integral, with us being on the verge of an integral age, coming out of a pluralistic stage that actually marked the 60s. And the rational stage itself being the foundation of the Western Enlightenment, the mythic stage being the foundation of religions taken in a concrete, mythic, literally true fashion, a fundamentalistic religion, for example, that believes that Moses really did part the Red Sea and God really did rain down frogs on the Egyptians and so on. And then before that, magic, which is more a kind of paganistic nature worship with different kinds of deities, polytheistic deities, a mountain god, a rain goddess, a river god, and so on. But these stages are part of our own unfolding from birth forward. And so an individual today goes through an archaic stage, and then starting at about 6 months or so, and for about 3 years, goes through a magical stage, worldview, and then moves into a mythic worldview, which dominates until about early adolescence, when reason starts to emerge and a rational worldview comes into being. And then starting in the 20s, if development continues, a pluralistic, multicultural, cultural creative, postmodern worldview can emerge. And all of those worldviews were called by Claire Graves first tier, because all of those felt that their values, and still feel today, that their values are the only true and correct values. So in our culture wars that we see going on full blast around the world, and particularly in this culture, we have three basic camps in the battle. One is the mythic fundamentalist religion, and they are vocal and very much believe that the Bible is literal truth and is the only truth, and that if you don't take Jesus into your life as your personal savior, that, you know, I really love you, but sorry, you're going to burn in hell for eternity. Then we have the rational modern camp, that is essentially scientific materialist and believes that although there are multiple interpretations of the universe, there's a way to find the correct one, and that's through scientific experiment. And so it's very much the basis of modern medicine, modern physics, modern biochemistry, molecular biology, and so on. And of course, it believes that the fundamentalist viewpoint is childish, infantile, not true, is a myth in the literal sense of Santa Claus. And, of course, the biblical fundamentalists return the honor and think that that science doesn't have, the truth at all. It's fine for helping fix things in the manifest universe, but has nothing to do with ultimate truth. And so you can be scientific all you want. You're still going to burn in hell forever if you don't embrace the one true way. And then fairly recently, 3 or 4 decades ago, was the emergence of the next major worldview, which was essentially has been known as postmodern. And it is of the belief that all knowledge is a social construction, and so there's not really anything that's universally true, that things that are called truth are simply like fashions or conventions, and that science is really has no more truth to it than does poetry. And so it's a very egalitarian, everybody is radically equal. It believes, of course, then that is true of science and fundamentalism, that they basically just have interpretations, and neither one of them are more or less true than the other one. And so it sort of lives its life according to that belief structure, which actually is the belief that its values of egalitarian and radical pluralism, are the only true values. And then there's an emergence of another couple of levels, and these were called second tier by Graves. And the reason, he also said that they represented, quote, a monumental leap in meaning. And these are the beginning of the various integral levels or systemic levels or holistic in the true sense. And these levels are different from first tier because they're the first levels that recognize intuitively that somehow that all of the first tier levels have some degree of truth to them or some significance to them. They're here for a reason. They're not to be just casually dismissed. And so there's a great, enormous degree of tolerance that comes into awareness with second-tier growth and development. And there's also a drive, a desire to unify and synthesize and integrate the different systems from all of the different levels at first tier. And so this is the first time that we actually see this in history, that we actually see a desire to not just pick one philosophy and argue that it's right and all the others are wrong, but to actually say, wait a minute, all philosophies have some degree of truth to them. Human beings are not capable of producing 100% error. As we say, nobody's smart enough to be wrong all the time. So there actually grows a true attempts to start unifying and synthesizing the world's knowledge. This also was marked by a degree in change in motivation that Abraham Maslow first spotted, who was one of the teachers of Claire Graves. And Maslow found that all first-tier stages were marked by what he called deficiency needs. So those are needs where you are deficient in something, and you need to go out and get it, and then you get it, and that satisfies it for a while, and then you're happy, and then sooner or later that runs out, you have to go out and satisfy it again. So I'm hungry, I have to go find something to eat, I eat, I feel better, pretty soon I'm hungry again, I'm deficient in food, I have to go out and get it, and so on. And all of the first tier stages are marked by deficiency needs. And for Maslow, these stages were physiological needs, safety needs, belongingness needs, self-esteem needs, and self-actualization. But then there was the leap to what he called self-transcendent, the integral levels, and there the motivation switched from deficiency needs to what he called being needs. And being needs are a motivation of superabundance. It's like you're given $1 billion, and one of the things you do with that is you go out and share it with your friends. You're motivated not by lacking money anymore, but by having an abundance of it. And so individuals at those stages aren't really motivated by those other needs. They're motivated by a superabundant, overflowing desire to share. So if we stop and kind of look at that picture, and we look at the Maslow and the Graves version of it, and then incidentally there are about a dozen different developmental models, each of them highlighting some different aspect of the human being that has developed. So there's cognitive models and ego development models, psychosexual models, and so on, all of which, of course, have evolved. And so there are models of the evolution of all of these different dimensions of the human being. But now if we look at what happens with enlightenment, and enlightenment tends to involve more what's referred to not as those structures of consciousness, like archaic, magic, mythic, and so on, but states of consciousness. And the contemplative traditions generally give about four or five major states, and they are waking state, dream state, deep formless sleep state. The fourth state, which is called Turiya, which is simply the Sanskrit word for fourth, and it is the pure self, the pure transcendental witness, the unqualifiable absolute self that witnesses everything that's arising moment to moment. And then Turiyatita, which is non-dual, which is the union of that self with all of the other manifest objects, with all gross, subtle, and causal, or waking, dream, deep sleep, objects. And so enlightenment is variously a state of getting into either Turiya, which is a state of nirvana with no qualities, or Turiyatita, the non-dual traditions, where you are simply one with everything that's arising moment to moment. But the fascinating thing is that you can get into these different states at virtually any of the structures that evolve. And so, but you will interpret the state of oneness, for example, a state of non-duality, you'll interpret that according to the structure that you're at. And there's evidence that humanity did the same thing. So 3,000 years ago, for example, if we're probably about the highest level was mythic, if an individual had a experience of oneness with everything, they would interpret that in mythic terms. And it would be whatever the particular religion that they belong to, and it would still very likely be interpreted in a concrete, literal fashion. But it would look at the world in a mythic, not archaic and not magic fashion. And so, and then the same thing happened when the rational stage emerged. And somebody having an experience of oneness would, of course, realize that the state is beyond reason. But when they sought to think about it and communicate it and talk about it and how they would explain it and understand it, they would do so in a rational fashion, not a mythic fashion. So we see the mythic religions die down, and religions like Buddhism is very rational. Theravadan Buddhism is very rational and very psychological, would start to emerge. And then so on with the pluralistic stage, and you can have a pluralistic enlightenment, so to speak, where you'll interpret your state of oneness in egalitarian, pluralistic terms. But then also, which is very recent, the capacity to have an integral enlightenment. And this would be the same union of emptiness and form as the others, except in this case, it's a second tier. The world of form is a second tier world. And that means that you have a sense of oneness, but that oneness literally does include all the other levels that have emerged to date. And so that's something that is a relatively new evolutionary unfolding. And there's no reason to believe that there aren't yet higher, you know, super integral structures. So just by seeing that the worldviews of humanity have evolved over the epochs, and then realizing that enlightenment is the union of emptiness and form, but that these forms have evolved, we can start to get a sense of really how significantly different the enlightenment experience could be over the years. And also, in this day and age, you can have somebody have a mythic experience of enlightenment, a rational experience of enlightenment, a pluralistic experience of enlightenment, a integral experience of enlightenment. And so that has changed the story a lot, because it's given us two scales to measure our the type of oneness that individuals have. So the structures are the way that we grow up and evolving through states are the way that we wake up. And both of these, of course, would be important. And now we have sort of a way to look at both of them and say, oh, okay, I'm at this particular structure. I need to grow up another structure or two. And I've evolved to a capacity to be aware of these, let's say, first four states, but I haven't yet really experienced the fifth state in a waking, conscious way. So I need to, in my meditation or contemplation, I need to work on that. And so we get a much more nuanced sense about how evolution has actually meant a change in how we experience spirituality. Of course, this world of form is spirit in action. It is the form body of spirit unfolding and evolving and growing through its own sport and play, its own lila, but with some very different outlooks along the way. And so this eats into the very core of what we consider to be enlightenment, and also ways to in a sense, measure it, ways to look at it and say, okay, how deep is my awakening experience, both how much have I grown up and how much have I wakened up, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty profound impact.
That's spectacular, Ken, and if evolution is in one way a move toward complexity, I mean, just the nuance and complexity even of that kind of profound integral evolutionary understanding of what development is
right.
itself a sign of humanity's evolution, because that's quite a story you just told. In terms of developmental theory, which you were taking us through a lot of just now,
mm-hmm.
one of the things that we're told about this new, either both postmodern level of development and also emerging integral levels of development,
uh-huh.
is that at this point in our human development, those of us at these stages have a much more profound sense of interiority, a much kind of more individuated self, much more kind of self-awareness, ability
right.
to be aware of our feelings. We have this inner world that people in previous stages of development did not have. And
right.
and one of the things, of course, that many have said about this in relation to the spiritual path is that, well, it's a hindrance because it tends to make us more narcissistic, because we've got this whole self world that we're kind of obsessed with that
right.
people didn't really used to have.
Right.
And yet one of the things I've been reflecting on a lot in developing my own work and reflecting on, you know, my whole kind of spiritual history with Andrew and everything else is how also, though, this newfound, deepened sense of interiority can also be a transform, can it be an accelerator on the spiritual path, and really can itself, is itself in many ways probably deepening the experience of the spiritual path and our potential to evolve in ways that probably never would have been possible before. And particularly the two things I've thought a lot about are both how this, I think, has given us a much greater capacity for introspection into
right.
into our motivations, into our shadows, into all the parts of ourselves that might have previously just remained unconscious.
Right.
And also in deepening our potential for relationship and intimacy, which is, I think, part of what's giving birth to this new collective spirituality where people are, you know, in spiritual inquiry going into higher states together and being able to kind of awaken the lower left quadrant, in a sense, to
right.
itself. So I wanted to just get your thoughts on it, because it's some of the things I've been thinking about. And
well, it's certainly yeah. true, because it's not just that evolution is deepening our sensitivity to our interiors. It's that evolution is adding layers to our interiors. So we look back and at the magical age, for example, and there were basically two major levels of consciousness. Still, as far as we can tell, five states, but only two structures, only two levels, archaic and magic. And so for you to be a fully grown up, fully developed human being 100,000 years ago, all you had was just one major transformation to pull off. And, of course, you could screw that up, and the ancient cultures do have understandings of what we would call mental illness today, and that's because they messed up that one stage of transformation. Today, there are seven stages of transformation, all seven of which you can screw up. So we can be sick in ways that older cultures literally couldn't even imagine. But it's also the case that there's more on the interior than there used to be. There's an actual laying down. Spirit is unfolding. Spirit is adding perspectives that it can take on its own world. So in the world of magic, for example, the most you can take is a one-person perspective. When you move to mythic, you can take a second-person perspective. And so the amount of care and goodness that you have will extend from being able to care for just yourself, which is egocentric, to being able to care and worry about your family or your tribe, or whatever your group is. It's ethnocentric. And then when we move to rational, we add and get a third-person perspective. And that really means all human beings. So that means that you can then care for people regardless of their race, color, sex, or creed. So in each of these stages of development, the pluralistic goes to fourth-person perspective and integral into fifth-person perspective. You're actually laying down another level of worldview. You're laying down another way that spirit can look at the world. You're laying down another level of consciousness. And that level has characteristics and traits and structures and drives. And we heard Maslow's motivations that each of those levels have. And so those represent, those are real structures in the universe. Those are actual, real, those levels of consciousness are as real as anything on the outside is. They're as real as rocks and stones and mountains and clouds and trees. And so you go from having, you know, one of these sedimented layers to two sedimented layers to three sedimented layers. It's at that third, it's at the level of reason that introspection, at least in today's individuals, first becomes possible. So in today's individuals, as they grow from archaic to magic to mythic, even at mythic, introspection is not really a characteristic of that stage. You get to rational, then all of a sudden a space is created where individuals can look within, and they find an inner world that they can explore and that they can see and that they can self-consciously start to explore. And we see the same thing happening in terms of perspectives in the world of art. If you look at, for example, Egyptian hieroglyphics and paintings, they're all two-dimensional. They're all, you know, a drawing of a person in just a two-dimensional form. Because that's at a mythic two-person perspective worldview. But when you get to the Renaissance and the beginning of the Enlightenment, where a third-person perspective is starting to emerge, and so you're going to start to get depth perception, actual third-person perception, all of a sudden portraiture and all the paintings become three-dimensional. And they just, all of a sudden, they just jump off the painting at you. And because that's a new world that has actually been added to the previous worlds, and it's a world that you can now start to introspect. And then it's still the rational level still tends to be oriented more, however, to the exterior world, hence the most common form of sort of less fleshed out worldview of the rational level is called scientific materialism. And it's just what it sounds like. It believes that just those third-person objects out there, just matter, is real. And even though I'm aware of this internal consciousness, it's not really real. It's just a product of the brain or something like that. But nonetheless, it's there. It can be introspected. And many philosophers, starting at that level, will make consciousness primary and will say, oh, no, actually, it's not a epiphenomena. It's the primary reality of the universe because we only know everything else through this medium of awareness and consciousness. So the fundamental reality of the universe is awareness. And then when we get to pluralistic, Graves even called that the sensitive self because it not only has interiors and has added a fourth person perspective, it now thinks interiors are as or more real than exteriors. So now we've come into a really full-fledged growth of interiors. And, of course, each of these then is adding a level of depth. And so in some sense, each one of these is adding a level of a possibility of wisdom, of seeing the world through more perspectives and of being able to see yourself through more perspectives. And so it's actually increasing the interiors that you can go exploring. And so, and then with integral, of course, it's even more so. And integral then itself sees a need and an importance of integrating the interiors with the exteriors. And so that's where we start to first find those kinds of philosophies emphasizing both interior exploration and exterior exploration. But all of that is an evolutionary growth. You see, all of that is an evolutionary unfolding. And so it's not just an increasing sensitivity to interiors, it's an actual growth of interiors that can be investigated.
This is really interesting, and it brings up for me a question I wanted to get into later, but I'm just going to jump into it now, which is, so given that, given the incredible growth in complexity and in interiority in all the ways you just described, and given that much of this broader, deeper territory is relatively new in our human history. I mean, postmodern level only emerged in the early last century in any real way, right? And now integral's just in its emergence now. So one of the big questions I know a lot of evolutionaries have who are leaning forward into evolutionary spirituality, integral spirituality, is, okay, what relevance do the great wisdom traditions have? Nobody wants to throw them out because they are such repositories of depth and beauty and wisdom and inspiration. Right. And yet when I hear everything you just laid out about how much has developed since all of those traditions not only emerged but really went through their major developments, and then here we are now in this kind of, not only in it's such a new world that would have been incomprehensible to people even a couple generations ago, but we're a new human, we're a new person. I mean, we're a new thing. We are, how we experience life, how we experience each other and relate, we're a new event. And to what degree is all that relevant? Where do you see it fitting in?
Right.
The wisdom of the past, in that sense.
Certainly one of the things that could happen in the past with some of the great religious pioneers is that they are not only moving through all five states of consciousness and having wakefulness be able to maintain an unbroken continuity through all of those changes of state. So through waking, dreaming, deep sleep, there's an unbroken continuity of wakefulness. And that was the fundamental meaning of enlightenment, to be awakened and not to be asleep at any point. And that was meant literally. But some of these pioneers jumped from the mythic into rational, pluralistic, and occasionally even integral. And these are the ones that stand out as really extraordinary religious texts. And they have this three-dimensionality to them, and they are just intrinsically powerful statements. And just reading them, you know, can give you goosebumps. It's like the Lankavatara Sutra, several of the Tantras, some of the Dzogchen, Mahaati material. And these are clearly coming from pluralistic or integral structures as well as non-dual state. But the important point is that they are, in essence, a repository of practices and techniques to help individuals move through states. And that's an extremely important learning curve, is how do we get wakefulness to move from its initial confinement in the waking state into the dream state and lucid dreaming, and then into the deep sleep state and continue to carry a thread until one is awakened as the true self, as the one and only true self. And then from there, have that true self, which is unqualifiable itself, without characteristics and pure emptiness, become one with all of those objects, all the objects in the waking state, all the objects in the dream state, all the objects in the deep formless state. And so the different kinds of practices that came down from these pioneers are profound treasure troves for humanity even to this day, because we have the same five states that we're dealing with. And a lot of the material, of course, going back 1,000 years B.C. and so on, is mythic and not yet non-dual. It's mythic and, for example, Theravadin, where samsara and nirvana are not yet understood to be one. So they're only at the fourth major state of consciousness. And the goal is to get rid of all of samsara, to get rid of all manifestation, gross, subtle, causal, and remain in absorption in the true self, in nirvana, in the unqualifiable, pure, empty ground of existence, and to simply get into that state and never come out. And so that's we can see that there's a evolutionary unfolding that was going on in these states as well. If you go back further than 6th century B.C. and the emergence of stuff like Theravadin, and you go back into the shamanistic period, there you don't find almost anything on states of consciousness having to do with pure emptiness or pure formlessness. They're mostly states of consciousness that are dream states of the upper world and underworld. In other words, subtle states. So wakefulness, in terms of the waking up scale, had only grown from the waking state into the subtle state, into the dream state. And mankind had not yet learned to push wakefulness into the deep causal state and into the true self state and into the non-dual state. So those would continue to grow, while at the same time, these structures would continue to grow. So what we call and the things that we find really useful today from these ancient traditions, of course, some of them now, individuals have simply continued to evolve and to evolve in a marching along with world consciousness as it evolves. So in other words, individuals today that practice shamanism, are almost certainly not practicing shamanism the way it was practiced 50,000 years ago when it was only the subtle state, because they've managed, using techniques that weren't strictly original shamanistic, but were taken from other traditions or even a deepening of their own tradition, to push into subtle, causal, and non-dual states. But we can, the ones that we find particularly useful, like and profound, and non-dual, and also approaching integral, those are ones like Tantra, and those were only developed during the 8th to the 11th century. In other words, those are pretty close to modern times. Those are not, 4,000 years old. Amount of wisdom literature coming from 4,000 years ago is pretty slim, frankly. So the stuff that we do find useful is getting to the point where, and then, of course, a lot of the great saints and sages that we love are, 17th century, 18th century. Dogen Zenji, the founder of modern Japanese Zen, it's just a few hundred years old. So those are the ones that still speak to us today, because their founders have pushed into pluralistic or integral, and they've also awoken through all five states. And that's really important, because one of the major differences between these structures of consciousness and the states of consciousness is that you cannot see structures when you look within. So there are, for example, six major stages of moral development. But if you sit on your meditation mat and look within, you'll never see a thought and you go, oh, that's moral stage five thought. That was obvious. Or Spiral Dynamics uses colors for its developmental levels, and you'll never sit on your cushion and say, oh, there goes a blue motivation, or there goes an orange motivation. You can't see them. They have to be discovered through basically studying large groups of people over time. But states, you can see. They're phenomenal realities. So you're perfectly aware when you get a state that feels like universal love. You are aware of that. And so we have, in the contemplative traditions, explicit instructions on how to move through the states. But nowhere do we really have instructions on how to move through the structures. And so that's one of the things. And as a matter of fact, we in the contemplative traditions, we don't even really have an understanding of the structures of consciousness, just the states, the five major states and what they look like as they're transformed and awakened to, but just almost nothing on the structures. So that is one of the areas that the modern and postmodern world can bring an enormous addition to a spirituality by showing this other developmental sequence and showing the various stages to it. There are multiple intelligences that we have. We probably have a dozen intelligences. We have a cognitive intelligence, a moral intelligence, an interpersonal intelligence, musical, mathematical, kinesthetic. Each of those develop through those levels of archaic, magic, mythic, rational, pluralistic, and integral. And so just learning about that and starting to learn ways to help us grow up in those structures can also, aid us in our attempt to wake up and to basically have both of these sequences come alive for us. The pioneers of a lot of the great religious movements, the contributions that they made that we still use aren't that old.
Really fascinating insight. That's great.
Yeah.
Thank you. And you're really interesting to talk to, Ken. I should have booked this for like 4 hours, just special special show. No, wouldn't have gotten you out of you probably. But I want to get one more question in before we go on to hear some other people's questions. And
sure.
It has to do with this whole notion that it's prevalent and it's a strong sense in those of us who are interested in evolutionary spirituality, which is this notion of conscious evolution, that we can consciously participate in furthering evolution. And many are lit up by this idea. Many people feel that we are doing this, that many of us are participating in this. And yet I often have people ask me, they say, Craig, that's such a grandiose idea that it's so full of hubris for us to think that somehow our actions and choices could really have a meaningful impact on something as large and impersonal as evolution.
Right.
And so I wanted to get your response to that. What does it mean to consciously evolve, particularly at a higher level? What does it mean to consciously participate in the evolution of consciousness and even of spirit itself?
Right. Well, of course, it could either be a sign of great, hubris, or a sign of grasping the actual reality of what's happening. So one of those is true, and take your pick. There's there's no way to prove one of them over the others, except look at all of the data, look at the big picture, and see which one of these seems to make most sense. And the one that makes most sense to me is that it's an evolving universe, and humanity is at the growing tip of that evolution. Now, if that's, it was Satchel Paige, the great baseball player, said, it ain't bragging if you done it.
Right.
And this isn't hubris if it's actually happening. If we are the growing tip of evolution, and certainly just to look at the tree of evolution puts humans at the very leading edge of an evolutionary unfolding, and that is to be taken with all humility. Clearly, it doesn't mean that humans therefore have the right to go out and destroy Gaia and abuse the Earth and do anything that bloody well pleases. It should mean the obvious. It should induce in us a great sense of humility in the fact that we are at a leading edge. But it also should occur that if this is true, and I do believe it to be true, that we acknowledge that truth and that we start to actually say, okay, how can I do this then? How can I be part of this conscious evolution in a way that is responsible, in a way that is genuine, in a way that is compassionate and loving and caring? Because I am actually laying down structures. With every move I make and every intention I have, I am laying down structures in my mind that will be passed on as realities to future generations. Like I said, we've had these six or so major emergences, major structures emerge during our growth and development. And we are now those who are participating in integral approaches to growth are actually helping to create the structure of the integral level. It's getting laid down by those who are practicing it. So it's sort of a new moral imperative, which is to act as if your every action is going to become part of evolution. And that shouldn't make us give us a sense of braggadocio. That should give us a sense of absolute humility and humbleness and a desire to get it right. But when we do that, when we start having then these glimpses of oneness, these glimpses of emptiness and form, then we can sense in us, in ourselves, that form is evolving, is moving forward. It has an eros in it. So it's not just a static. Enlightenment is no longer just a static realization where you realize Brahman as being and that's it. As you realize Brahman as being, the world is illusory, Brahman alone is real, Brahman is the world. And the world is evolving. And so therefore, to realize our oneness with Brahman is to realize that we are evolution. We are the very core of evolution itself. And so wake up to that. And, you know, let us live with that as part of our consciousness and part of our wakefulness. And I know that's certainly been part of your path, that type of understanding.
Big
and
time.
I think it's, you know, increasingly becoming a better understood principle of spirituality.
That's beautiful, Ken. I'm sitting here thinking, okay, I have to get all my current students to listen to this because this is something I really talk a lot about, you know, the obligation that we have at this point, that those of us with the luxury and the freedom and the level of development to be able to engage in this work, that it's so not about us at this point.
Exactly.
And, you know.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah, and it is a duty. It is an obligation. And that's one of the meanings of Dharma, of course, is duty. And this is our new Dharma. There's an integral Dharma. Spirit keeps unfolding. You know, there's no reason on earth that we would expect spirit to, you know, after all, it produced the Big Bang, and it didn't just sit there then with you know, a few material atoms lying around. It started self-organizing. It started producing more and more complex forms. It started bringing life forms out of dead and sentient matter. And out of life forms, it brought mind. Out of mind, it's starting to bring soul and spirit. It's a very, very active spirit. And spirit in action is evolution.
Beautiful. Thank you. That's a great, couldn't be a better end to this part of it. Before we go into getting some other people's questions, I do just want to give you a moment to share maybe anything you're working on now or anything you want to turn people on to. Obviously, if people want to learn more about you, they can go to integrallife.com, kenwilber.com, integralinstitute.org. Is there anything you want to tell us about or turn us on to or invite us into that you're working on or up to? Just wanted to give
Yeah, I've got about, in a weird series of events, I've ended up with about 6 books that I have that are about 90% completed. And it's just so irritating to have all of them, you know, almost ready to go, but not quite ready to go. In the meantime, I would recommend both Integral Life Practice Handbook and my particular latest Integral Spirituality, which will sort of bring people up to date on a lot of this stuff. And then, yes, indeed, by all means, check out integrallife.com and see what we're up to over there.
Yeah, those are both great books. And Integral Life Practice is really taken off. Have you noticed? I mean, that book's getting around and people more and more interest. It's really cool.
It is. Yeah. And one of the reasons is you can use it as a self-guide manual. So you can, you know, do the practices on your own. And so people appreciate that.
Yeah, great. Okay, well, beautiful. So we'll now move into the Q&A section of the evening. If you have a question, you can send it to us via instant message in the teleseminar window on your computer, or you can dial into the conference line number and press *2 to let us know that you have a question. Before we take your questions, though, just a few things to let you know about from our sponsors. First, if you're interested in diving deeper into what it means to live an evolutionary life and discovering what it means to put evolutionary spirituality into practice, I want to let you know that registration is now happening for the spring session of our 9-week Integral Enlightenment telecourse starting in April. You can learn more about that and other upcoming Integral Enlightenment course offerings at academyforevolutionaries.com. That's academyforevolutionaries.com. I also want to thank our partners at Gaia Community, an online sanctuary of nearly 300,000 seekers, artists, and visionaries committed to inspiring and empowering each other to live lives of purpose and authenticity, as well as at Gaia Soulmates, a fledgling dating site for singles seeking a partner who shares their values of spiritual awareness and personal inquiry. That's Gaia.com, G-A-I-A.com. Also, if you're enjoying this series, you might want to check out Women on the Edge of Evolution, a free
teleseminar series featuring 21 of the world's leading female thinkers, scientists, spiritual luminaries, artists, and agents of cultural change for an unprecedented conversation about women's role in shaping the future. They have 45,000 women already participating in this dynamic online community. You can register today at womenontheedgeofevolution.com. And finally, if you live in or near the San Francisco Bay Area and are interested in integral things and evolutionary things, you're invited to participate in a unique experiment in integral and evolutionary spiritual community. Starting just next week, Terry Patton, who's the author of co-author with Ken of Integral Life Practice, the book we were just talking about, and me together are going to guide a collective exploration of what it means to sustain an authentic integral evolutionary spiritual practice amidst the complexities and challenges of modern life. You can learn more about it at awakeningtogethercourse.com, awakeningtogethercourse.com. Okay, that's it for the ads. If you have a question again, send it to us via instant message in that teleseminar window in front of you, or dial into the conference line number and press star 2. Let's see who we have with a hand up. Okay, one sec here. Looks like my interface is freezing momentarily. Huh. This has actually never happened at this moment. hey, David, you want to put somebody on? I've got to wait for my...
We have a caller from East Rochester, New York. You're on the line.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, hi, this is Sue, yes. And
hi, Sue.
Ken, I just want to say, I hope that you have put in your will, you will will your brain to science. I would like to see it right up against Einstein's. I have a feeling you have evolved his by far.
I second the motion.
You can feel it.
Well,
I hate to say this. I'm an Ayurvedic health consultant, and they say that baldness has to do with tremendous fire in the brain. I think that's why you're bald. You have so much incredible firing going on in your brain. It must be constant.
Thank you.
Not to say that you're a hothead. There's a positive and the negative. And
I got it.
I would
Thanks
say
too.
what you're giving to the world is extremely positive.
Thank you.
I do want to ask, now, you know, I just love how you've taken us on this journey from the archaic and the magical and the pagan and the mythical, and, you know, taken us from the past into the present, not only in our physical form, but also the implications of the spiritual connection between our evolution and the role of spirit on man.
Right.
You know, you've referred to some of the Vedic, I think, influences, and then the Buddhist influences.
Sure.
So now I'm wanting to get to the question, which is how much do you, we're now talking about a present time, which is more of the integral consciousness of,
right,
of our oneness, which, of course, are the body of teachings that were revealed by Baha'u'llah during a 40-year period between 1852 and 1892.
Uh-huh.
So I'm just wondering how much thought you've given to that, and how much we can attribute his revelation, a 40-year period of incredible revelation of sacred teachings, to the evolution on the planet that we're seeing right now.
Yeah, and I think it is an example of just that, an evolutionary growth, and one that is, you know, occurring, you know, fairly recently.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an important point, because, you know, a lot of the traditions we think of as being wise just because they're very, very old.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to be a little bit careful about that. There certainly is wisdom in virtually any of the traditions going back, you know, for considerable stretches of time. But we shouldn't overlook that so many of the saints and sages that we hold up as being really amazing are ones like, you know, Ramana Maharshi, who's you know, just a few decades since his life. And so not to, you know, just shortchange and to remember that a lot of the really great saints and sages are ones that are relatively recent. And I think that 40-year period is just an example of that. And that's just occurring in the late 1800s.
Thanks for your question, Sue. Really appreciate it. Let's hear from John Thomas Davis in Austin. Hey, you're on.
Hey.
Hey, John.
Thanks a lot. Again, appreciate your work. And through your books, I found out about Gene Gebser. And,
yes.
Read his great work, The Ever-Present Origin.
Right.
And of his, unfortunately, I guess, of his 13 or so books, that's the only one that's been translated into English. So.
Yeah, it is. It is unfortunate.
Yeah. So that's the only one I've read, although I understand there's a couple more that are in the process of being translated.
Oh, let's hope.
Yeah, let's hope. But I was just curious, can you think back to when you first discovered Gebser, and can you speak a little bit about what effect he had on you, and can you speak a little bit about his life as far as you know about it, and about his importance to the ideas that we're all involved
right.
and interested in?
Yes, I do remember, and it was a special issue of a rather extraordinary journal that was published at the time called Main Currents in Modern Thought. And they had both a summary of all of his stages and excerpts from his opus. And this was right at the time that I was doing Up from Eden. And so the number of individuals who had theories and philosophies and works that were out there that really gave a good evolutionary understanding of human culture, it was just very, very thin. And as a matter of fact, most of the spiritual teachers, including Jacob Campbell and Alan Watts and so on, you know, had a romantic view, which was that human beings had been in, you know, a real Eden, and that we really did fall.
Yeah.
And so having, you know, an understanding of the evolutionary unfolding in probably its more, you know, correct forms, with both the pluses and the minuses of each of the major levels, was just... it was fantastic, because they were essentially the same levels that I had come up with independently. But to find a guy that really clearly knew what he was talking about, essentially support you know, the view that I had taken, was absolutely wonderful.
Mm.
It was just one of the finest moments in my intellectual career. I was just ecstatic with that.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, on balance, of course, you can look back at pioneers and you can nitpick. And it, you know, now it's quite certain that we have multiple intelligences and they develop at relatively independent rates. So it's not just, you know, archaic, magic, mythic, so on. There's these dozen intelligences, each at their own rate, going through these different levels, and he kind of confused. He sort of mushed together pluralistic and integral, and that's understandable, because real integral stages weren't hadn't emerged at the time that he was writing. So he was quite a bit of foresight to see integral components at all. And so his highest stage, the integral a perspectival, was both a real pioneering foresight and a little bit of a confusion, a little bit of a mushing together of two different stages. And so I usually, when I'm giving a quick summary of him, without giving a lot of detail, I usually just separate the two and say pluralistic and integral. But he had an absolutely keen capacity and perception for noting patterns in culture and what was important and what wasn't important, and being able to see how they all came together and how they unfolded in, you know, this magnificent lattice work of worldviews. And I mean, he's just one of the truly, truly great and unfortunately underappreciated geniuses of human anthropology. And my discovery of him was a revelation.
Well, that's wonderful, wonderful. That's the way I feel, too. And I think that one of the things I admire about him is sort of like one of the things I admire about you is you're not just an ivory tower intellectual. You involve yourself with artists and other writers and
right.
and people of our time. And Gebser did the same thing in Europe. You know, of course, he died in 73, but he involved himself in his moving around Europe. He was friends with Picasso and many of
right.
the other artists of his time.
Right.
So he was not just an ivory tower intellectual. He
yeah.
enjoyed living life and getting out there. So thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Okay. Okay, I've got a bunch of really interesting questions coming in through instant message here. Blake Anderson in Calgary asks, said, you spoke about past religious pioneers. How do current integral pioneers explore greater potentials of enlightenment? If they're truly at the leading edge, how do they validate their knowledge when there are so few who are at the same stage? In other words, how do you know you're actually exploring new territory and not the same old path?
Yeah, and the answer is there is just no way to know. All you can do is if you are at an integral level of development, then presumably the judgment that got you there is, you know, more often right as wrong. And so you can just continue to rely on your own judgment in deciding these issues. But it's a really important question, and it's the type of question that needs to be asked and that needs to be discussed. There's a lot of confusion in the integral field as people come into it and start to explore it. There's a lot of judgments that people think are integral and they're really not. And it really is a wild, wild west of a pioneer frontier, but all of it is still absolutely fascinating because it really is one way or another the leading edge of evolution's unfolding, and so there will arise somehow ways to answer those kinds of questions, because otherwise the individuals that are making those judgments, their judgments just won't tetramesh, that it won't be selected by evolution to be carried forward, and so their incorrect judgments will increasingly fall off of the scene, and we'll just see less and less of them and more of the judgments that are correct being ones that are selected and carried forward. But we are right at that time, and there's only been, six other times in human history that a truly major evolutionary transformation has occurred, and we are right in the middle of that era. It's extraordinary. Even more extraordinary is that using the first tier and second tier divisions of Abe Maslow and Claire Graves and a few others, this is the first time in history that we have a tier transformation. We have never gone from one tier to another. There's only been tier one and its six major stages. Now we're going through a stage transformation, namely from pluralistic to integral, that is also a tier transformation from first tier to second tier. That's never happened. So it's why, you know, we are at a truly extraordinary crossroads in history, and history itself is literally being made and being is emerging and being laid down. So these kinds of questions are exactly the kinds of questions that are going to come up more and more and more and more. How do I know I'm doing the right thing? How do I know what to do? Which way should I turn? Which way is forward? Which way is backward? And that's why, you know, the best thing we can do is just create these integral communities like Craig is doing and like we're doing at Integral Life, and put people together so we can all sort of pool our knowledge, our understanding, our best guesses, our hunches, and our wisdom, and find ways to move forward. But this has never happened in history, a stage transformation that's also a tier transformation. This is just absolutely unbelievable.
Fantastic. Thanks, Ken. That was really rich. And thank you for your question. I have another Canadian question from Alain in Boucherville in Quebec. Says it's a path question. He says, "Hi Ken, I found it hard to relate to God when all my images of God no longer held. Then I found your 1-2-3 of God perspective, which was very useful. I'm now more comfortable with first and third person experiences of God. But I'm wondering, do you pray or dialogue with God? What's the value for you in a second-person relationship with God? Do you have a representation or image of God when you pray or dialogue? And is there a way to relate to God as other without anthropomorphism? Or is that part of the game?"
Right. Yeah, really good questions. And for those who don't know, briefly what I did in looking at our images of God is to point out that we have three major perspectives that we find in all languages, a first-person perspective, a second-person perspective, and a third-person perspective. First-person is the person speaking, so that would be me right now while I'm talking. Second-person is the person being spoken to, so that would be Craig when I'm talking and me when he's talking. And third-person is the person or thing being spoken about. So it's a like him, her, they, them, it, its. And we actually have entire traditions that picture God using just one of those perspectives. And as a matter of fact, most traditions just use one of those perspectives. So third-person traditions are like the Great Web of Life, which is very popular today in New Age spirituality and in leading-edge spirituality, and is usually tied in with systems theory and sciences like that that talk about interwoven networks, all in third-person it terminology, so they're, you know, kind of leaving out the interiors of first and second. But they are as holistic as they can be in third person, and that's the third person is the way they're spoken about. Second person is, of course, quite familiar to most people. It's God as this great other, and it's the traditional theistic stance, although the mystics in those theistic stances often cross over the line. And move to the last major way that God and Spirit has been conceived historically, and that's as first person. And so that's as literally my own true self is identical with the one true Spirit of the entire cosmos. And so we have this first, second, and third person perspectives. And what happened in the West is that our spiritual intelligence line, which could go from archaic to magic to mythic to rational to pluralistic to integral, got stuck for lots of complicated reasons at the mythic level. And so most people in the West, when they think about God, they think about God in second person and in a mythic form. So they think that it really is the God that part of the Red Sea and rained frogs down and so on, and is part of the Trinity of persons. And so it's really unfortunate in our culture that that happens, because then when they move into the college years and they go to college and the rational level starts to emerge and they are from a background of faith and they want to keep their faith, they want to keep their belief in spirit, they can't discuss it with their professors because their professors will, you know, make fun of it and belittle it. Any notion of spirit is put down by, you know, most rational academic settings today. And yet they're kind of embarrassed by their fundamentalist friends. They're believers who stay at the mythic level and believe that in a concrete, literal form. And so they are literally cut out of a way to have any spirituality that speaks to them. And so it's not surprising, under these circumstances, an astonishing 75%, this is a recent survey out of UCLA showed, an astonishing 75% of college juniors pray.
Wow.
But, yeah, I know. It's like three out of four pray, but they do it in the closet. They don't tell their friends. And so because they're stuck, and what they want, of course, is a way to take their spiritual understanding into a rational interpretation and then into a pluralistic, postmodern interpretation. There are dozens of books out called the Postmodern Bible that give an entirely postmodern reinterpretation of the Gospels and even an integral approach to faith. And so it's just been a travesty that spiritual intelligence has gotten stuck at the mythic level. Because, of course, it can continue to grow and evolve and help people grow and evolve with it. And when I first started writing about this, most of the people that were involved in spirituality had, of course, long ago given up on that mythic version. So they had given up on Judaism and Christianity and Islam and were practicing, you know, Buddhism or Taoism or Hinduism or something like that, which was essentially a first-person form of spirituality. And then about the other half were practicing third-person forms where they pictured spirit as a great interwoven Gaia network. And then when I included second-person and explained how that was equivalent and was a legitimate way to look at spirit, what happened for a lot of people was enormous kind of release and a kind of relief, because they had cut off one of their own intelligences at a very early level of its own growth and had kind of frozen it there and had therefore also, you know, come to a disjuncture with their own culture. And that had not really set well with their psyche. It really caused a kind of a dissociation, a fracture, a brokenness in their own being, because they were pushing that perspective of spirit out. And so to just see that there can be what we call a 1-2-3 of spirit, the first, second, and third person of spirit, just helped them enormously. And that's what it basically did for me. And in terms of the way I picture second person, is a great mystery and a great other, but a person is any being with intelligence. And so when I think of God as a person, that's how I think of it, as just basically a substance with intelligence. It's not my first way of thinking about spirit, which is probably first person, then third person, then second person. But it does and make room for individuals to literally do things like have, you know, conversations with God, because you can have the type of a Neil Donald Walsh conversations with spirit And spirit will answer, really, according to your own level of development. So it tends to work out just fine if you want to sit down and write out a series of conversations with God and ask this person questions and so on. And it turns out to be a very powerful practice in many ways. And again, because what will happen is it'll free not the mythic God, although it will undo that and let that mythic God grow up, but it'll come from the rational or pluralistic or integral level that you're at. And so you can get into a conversation with God at a grown-up level and, you know, help clear out all the infantile notions of God in second person. And then some people have just, second person has just opened up for them so powerfully that it's now their favorite form of practice, and that is how they practice. And it's got, you know, one thing that I have found is enormously useful about doing at least some degree of second person practice is that when you do first person and third person, there's still room for your ego to hide out, because you can still be egoic and believe in God in first person and God in third person. But for you to picture God as something wholly other than you are is a truly transcending, ego-deconstructing practice. And it just doesn't leave any room for you. You are out of the divinity picture. And so that's a very powerful way to sort of clean up your own awareness and get rid of the self-contraction by working with the perspective of spirit from a second person.
Hmm. Beautiful answer. Thank you, Ken. Wish we could go on and on, but we've crossed over our time here. But I just really want to thank you for making the time and for just everything you brought. This was incredibly rich. And
I love you, my friend, and I'm more than glad to do this, glad to be with you, and I really, really enjoyed the conversation.
Hey, man, I love you too. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, buddy.
Me too. Great. All right, take care.
Okay, pal. Bye now.
Bye now. If you want to learn more about the work of Ken Wilber, visit integrallife.com, kenwilber.com, or integralinstitute.org. I think integrallife.com is where you'll find the most kind of richness. It's the one they are giving the most attention to, and there's a lot of dialogues with Ken and teachings by Ken there. So I invite you to check him out more and check out his books. Integral Spirituality goes into great detail about a lot of what he was just sharing about the three faces of God. So well worth getting into. All right, and Integral Life Practice gives you practices for engaging all of those, so just encourage that. Okay, just a few reminders here. If you're interested in diving deeper into the conversation that we began tonight, you can join our Facebook group where you can participate in discussion forums on any of the topics we discussed today. Just go to facebook.com, search for Awakening the Impulse to Evolve, or just click on the link in the email we sent you this morning. If you want to learn more about my work, visit integralenlightenment.com or academyforevolutionaries.com. And if you have any friends that might be interested in this series, please feel free to forward them one of our emails so they can join us. And if someone sent you this audio or you found it somewhere on the Internet and you'd like to listen to the other 18 dialogues in the series, visit evolutionaryspirituality.com. Finally, I want to thank all the partners and sponsors who've made all this possible, including our event partners, Gaia Community and Enlighten Next, and our sponsors, The Shift Movie, Women on the Edge of Evolution, Feminine Power, Integral Incubator, Integrative Spirituality, Next Step Integral, Global Mind Shift, Elevate Films, iEvolve, and Bay Area Integral. And a reminder to tune in this Thursday for my dialogue with Dr. Elizabeth DeBold, senior editor of Enlighten Next magazine, best-selling author, and powerful, passionate evolutionary soul. She's going to be speaking about the liberating power of an evolutionary worldview, awakening the developmental process in consciousness and culture. All right. Now we're going to shift gears and get started on our virtual evolutionary cafe. Each week immediately following the teleseminar, you have an opportunity to come together with fellow evolutionaries in a facilitated conference call environment, get into a small group, and explore the topics we discussed here. To do that, you need to create a personal PIN code. There's information about how in the email we sent you yesterday. So hope to see you on the other side. The cafe starts in just 3 minutes. We're going to start at 10 minutes past the hour, so go ahead and jump over there, and we'll see you there. Thanks, everybody.